Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in French Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roxanne Panchassi. My guest in this episode is Judith Cercas, the author of Sex, Law, and Sovereignty in French Algeria, 1830 to 1930. And the book was published by Cornell University Press in 2019. Hi there, Judith.
Hi, Roxanne.
I am so delighted and grateful that you're able to speak with me today. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time.
Yeah, me too. So, Judith, before we get started, could you just let us know how you're doing, where you are, how the last year, I guess, of global pandemic has been treating you?
I can't complain. I'm in central New Jersey, where it's quiet and there are lots of places to go for long walks. So I adopted the sourdough craze and make bread every week. So there's that good that's come of it.
So, I mean, we're going to talk about all sorts of things, but, you know, I always ask authors how they originally became interested in working on France, and in your case, on France and Algeria. So how do you want to get us there? Whatever you want to tell us about your interest and where it came from.
Well, how France? I guess it was really, I was never, I would say, a Francophile from the start. I was not driven by a kind of, you know, fantasy or passion for things French. I was more when I was in college at Brown at the height of the moment of French theory and began, you know, reading and studying. Foucault, amongst others, was obviously a major influence on me and my work. And I guess it really just was interested in delving deeper both into the history of French thinkers and also the contexts that they worked on. And in particular, developing an interest in feminism and history of sexuality, which was part of the strong connection to Foucault. Already in college, was working on, you know, topics on the history of sexuality and wrote an undergraduate thesis on working class women's sexuality and hysteria. And then went to graduate school in intellectual history, seeking to continue to do that kind of work, kind of at the intersection between theoretically informed approaches to historical work and working on questions of bodies, sexualities, difference, religion, and race. Ultimately, the dissertation and first book that I wrote was about sex and secularism, focusing on the masculinity of citizenship in the early first half of the Third Republic. And in that work, had a brief discussion of efforts to bring secularized schooling or secular schools to Algeria, and essentially happened upon a whole kind of world of discussion surrounding the problem of Muslim law in relationship to French secular principles that revealed an intense focus on and fascination with the dimensions or dynamics of Muslim family law. And I just sort of realized that there was an immense archive that had really, up until this was, you know, I guess in the late 2000s, not really been mined. And that was sort of what got me started on my way.
The first sentence of, well, the introduction, Judith, really, it's an amazing first sentence. The French conquest of Algeria was sexualized from the outset. So just to start off, I guess I want to ask you to kind of tease that out for us a bit. Like, what do you mean by that? And how does that kind of set a keynote, I guess, for the rest of the book?
Well, my interest in framing the introduction in those terms was to suggest the extent to which this is a story with which we're sort of already familiar, given all of the, you know, decades of work informed by feminist kind of discussions of Orientalism, the Orientalist imaginary that informed colonial projects of conquest and occupation. And as I describe, you know, I found actually at the very end of my research, a whole trove of cartoons or, you know, lithographs, caricatures depicting the conquest in explicitly sexualized terms. French soldiers arriving in Algiers, invading these phantasmatic harems and tearing Algerian women from their interior into the exterior. They really rendered explicit the extent to which this was a kind of founding fantasy, right? That the conquest of Algeria would be a conquest of its women. And on some level, you know, as I said, this is a trope with which we're familiar based on generations of valuable scholarship done by feminist post-colonial theorists and historians, especially of the Middle East. What I was interested in exploring further was how these fantasies also play themselves out in the domain of law. The passage of the initial legal framework of colonization, especially starting in 1834, was on some level meant to keep in check some of the most violent excesses, at least in theory. Of course, in practice, things went differently. But nonetheless, also entailed a certain sexualized fantasy, namely that the legal organization of the colony would protect the sanctity or imagined sanctity of the Muslim or Algerian interior, even as it helped to organize and facilitate the transfer of property from Algerians to the French, right? So we have a kind of founding, you know, founding violence that and a founding sexualized violence that is then you know, transformed and stabilized in the legal regime of distinct and separate jurisdictions for French and European, Muslim, Algerian, and Jew beginning in 1834.
Yeah. Just to sort of pick up on what you just said, Judith, law is, well, it's one of those words that's like singular, plural, it holds so much when you use it. And that in this context in particular, the context of this first century of colonialism in Algeria, what you're dealing with in the book is multiple systems of law, you know, an allegedly universal French law that isn't, of course, not universal even in the context of France, and it's certainly not in the context of Algeria, changes in the law over the course of that 100-year period, and then the relationship between French law and Muslim law. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, the challenge of sorting that out and juggling that as a researcher and a writer in this project?
Yeah, especially since before working on this project, I really had not cast myself or understood myself as a legal historian. My first book, while focused on citizenship, was not, it was in a sense about law, but in a kind of very, broad, it was about the kind of, ideas that subtended the development of Republican legal principles surrounding citizenship, but it did not study law and legal cases in detail. So that was really a significant innovation for me. And a major challenge. And in a sense, I had to teach myself that kind of, history and practice of French colonial law, which is basically what, over the course of the 10 years that I spent, researching and writing the book is what I did. And, I was lucky enough to have access to the major legal digests of colonial law and jurisprudence in Algeria before they were all digitized, and was able to literally page through them in order to track the development of colonial law. Mm-hmm. The book is about the colonial legal archive. And I absolutely immersed myself in it in order to attempt to understand both the facts and the fantasies on which its development was based, and really looking at the conflicts and contests that motivated its consolidation from the outset.
At some level, Judith, the book is really pursuing the relationship and the kind of forced connections and segregation of, land and property law on the one hand, and the entities of land and property, and then these, gendered bodies and persons on the other hand, whether we're talking about the gendered bodies and persons of settlers or of indigenous Algerians. So could you talk a little bit about that relationship between land and bodies, and how you think of that as a kind of theme that runs throughout the project?
Yes, because that really for me is the kind of crucial hinge and insight around which the whole of the book is organized. So as I mentioned at the outset, I really came to the project after finding these remarkable archive of discourse, a discernible fascination with the kind of sexualized character of Muslim family law, especially in the 1870s and 1880s, which was the period in the first book that I discussed where their efforts to bring secularized schooling to Algeria, and the whole debate surrounding whether or not it would be feasible summoned the question or the problem of the Muslim family and family law and its protections on polygamy, forced marriage, and repudiation, which is this kind of triplet of tropes that are used to characterize the excesses, the sexualized excesses of Muslim family law that just return repeatedly, and in certain ways to this day. So as I went back into the archive of discussions of colonial law and jurisprudence, I tried to trace the genealogy of that fascination. And what I realized going back in time before the 1870s was that earlier discussions of polygamy were not focused exclusively on either its religious character or its exclusive connection to fantasy of the family, but it was also bound up with questions about the law regulating Algerian land. Part of what I'm trying to trace in the book is how did the idea of the kind of difference of Muslim law come to be focused on the family, given the fact that Muslim law, as it operated in Algeria and elsewhere prior to the arrival of the French, dealt with every aspect of life, right? So how, in a sense, did Muslim law as family law emerge as an imagined distinct body of law? What I was able to trace was the emergence of what Historians who work on the history of colonial law are familiar with it, which is to say the category of Muslim personal status, right? Which in a lot of the important, existing literature on the history of French Algeria or colonial Algeria and other French colonial entities and bodies of law, right, is the domain of law that is devoted to marriage, divorce, inheritance, right? So really focused on the family. And what I learned from my research was that while this is, first of all, a French legal category, not a Islamic or Muslim law category, right? It's derived from Roman law and had historically been important, particularly in French Ancien Régime law, right? It was used to manage the kind of legal pluralism in Ancien Régime France of Normandy custom versus civil law in the South, for example, or the custom of Paris. And all of this was, at least in theory, done away, I mean, the revolution and then cemented by the civil code, right, according to which all French nationals are supposed to have a shared personal status, which is to say French nationality, right, which they carry on their persons everywhere that they travel. Right. So the problem introduced by Algerian, the conquest and colonization was how to manage different bodies of law, at least initially Muslim law, starting in 1834, comprised all domains of law with the exception of criminal law, right? So, property or landed property and as well as marriage would be regulated by Muslim law. But over the course of the following decades, and this is part of what I do trace in the first three chapters of the book, especially with increasing efforts to develop civilian settlement, Muslim law comes to be seen as a greater and greater obstacle to the projects of settlement. And so there is a push in the particular on the part of civilian settlers to, at least for those domains or those territories that were particularly desirable for settlement, to transform the legal character of the land in order to place it under French legal jurisdiction.
Yeah, I think one of the ways that you say that that I found really sort of clear and compelling is when you somewhere and you reiterate this at different points that, that the French sought to assimilate Algerian land, but not Algerians.
Yes, and I think that the frequent characterization of the nature of French colonialism, especially in the kind of facile opposition between, for example, French and British colonial approaches, is the French are assimilationist. Well, yes, the French were absolutely assimilationist in Algeria, but really what they cared about Frenchifying was the land. And literally that was the language that they used, right? So the major piece of land reform legislation that I study, the Varnier Law from 1873, this is the way in which it was imagined, was that the project was to make the land French while keeping the people who lived on it and owned it before they were expropriated, and the law was in fact designed to achieve their expropriation, would remain Muslims. And despite the supposed avenues opened up by the 1865 law, the Senatus Consult, that created pathways to citizenship. In fact, the structure of the law and the disincentives to actually becoming French were so many that indeed the real project was to Frenchify the land and leave the people who owned it as Muslim.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's one of the most fascinating things about the book for me, Judith, that you, you know, not only illuminate that distinction between law as it laws as they apply to property and as they apply to bodies and persons, but that you are able to explain and show how the history of that contradictory but totally beneficial, at least for French settlers and the French, holding of or claiming simultaneously of a respect for the difference of the Muslim family, you know, marriage, relationships between men and women, all of these things, while also seeing and holding the Muslim family and all of those things in a pretty serious kind of disdain over time.
Right. They claim a language of protection and preservation, which, and this is part of the kind of founding fantasy that I'm demonstrating as operating from the outset when we were, you know, talking about the, you know, the sexualized from the outset, that there were certain fantasies mm-hmm. about the Muslim family that are operating from the outset. And that continues to inform the vision of the Muslim family that is purportedly being protected, even as it remains also a source of disdain or contempt, and indeed, you know, kind of pathologization mm-hmm. and locus of imagined excess and perversion, right? Yeah. So, and part of what I try to demonstrate is the kind of projective dimensions of that that vision, right? So that there's there's a kind of fantasy of the patriarchal excess of the Muslim family that is always also shared by the jurists who are writing about it. Right. Mm-hmm. So they kind of imagine themselves into the position of the Muslim patriarch, allow themselves to indulge in that fantasy, and yet also celebrate themselves or valorize themselves for, in a sense, not being that figure. Mm-hmm. Right. So they get to both indulge in the, you know, in the fantasy, and condemn it at the same time, and that sort of Janus-faced structure is internal to the, you know, dynamic or operation of the law itself.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's so exciting about what you're doing here, and you point this out in different ways throughout the project, is that, you know, it makes sense, a certain kind of sense, that all of this is about, I think, you know, you say like material political gain, like conquest is enabled by French law and these distinctions and differences that are maintained over the 100-year period that the book covers, and then even after that in different ways, and that land grabbing for settlement, like all of that has a logic to it that and that makes a certain kind of sense, but that it isn't just about material and political gain, that there's this affective dimension, this psychological dimension and an emotional dimension to what's happening here in this history that you're exploring. Could you say a little bit about how you kind of bring those things together, this study of this kind of material interests and investments with the affective investments?
Yes. Thank you for that question, because it is, that's another kind of core insight and project of the book, is to think those two things together, right? Mm-hmm. So as I say in the introduction, I mean, it is impossible to write the history of the colonization of Algeria without foregrounding the settler colonial project. You know, and I make that clear from the outset, right, that the design of the legal system by its author, Justin Nahalse, is to facilitate land transactions, right? And, you know, arrive at, in the most efficient and effective way, at facilitating land transfer, right? And that the idea is that the protection of the family and patriarchal right is initially going to be the way to achieve that end. The rapaciousness of the soldier, right, is both embarrassing to the French and ineffective, right? So again, it's impossible to write this history without foregrounding that drive and interest behind the settler colonial project. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I found that beginning with that thought or premise could not adequately explain or help us to understand the fascination and focus on the imagined, you know, pleasures and perversions of the patriarchal Muslim family.
Just to kind of follow up on that, like to make it real explicit, part of what you're doing in this book that I think is really compelling and exciting is, you know, bringing psychoanalytic concepts and ways of thinking to the study of colonialism and law in this period. And so words have already come up, like phantasmatic and kind of pleasure of, you know, male French jurists fantasizing about the patriarchal Muslim heads of families. But could you talk a little bit about that sort of methodological choice and move to read this history through psychoanalysis to a certain extent and through this Lacanian notion of extimacy? Maybe even tell us what extimacy is.
One of the things that I became, you know, kind of troubled and fascinated by was how to account for dynamics of repetition across story of continuity, right? And how to understand the intense fascination and fixation that jurists, as well as, you know, artists and literary figures have with the patriarchal imaginary and, you know, pleasure, excess, and violence that is imagined realm of Muslim personal status or family law. And this was really my kind of sources speaking to me, because I just, you know, found the, you know, repetition of the fascination with polygamy, with forced marriage. Repudiation is seen as a kind of an extension of polygamy that revealed a kind of projective desire that was in excess of something that could be simply described as desired for land. Mm-hmm. One of the ways in which this becomes clarified is in particular in accounts of why it would be unfair or unjust for Muslim men, you know, so Muslim Algerian men who are allowed to maintain their personal status. And over again, you have public officials, politicians, and jurists essentially saying that it would be unfair for men to be at once polygamous and have full rights as citizens. Mm-hmm. Right, so that on some level they would be getting access to an imagined excess of sexual pleasure that Frenchmen would be in some way denied because of the strictures of monogamy written into the civil code. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is what I describe as the dynamic of extimacy, in which the kind of transgressive, imagination of sexual pleasure, of an excessive sexual pleasure, or jouissance, is projected onto this other who, you know, is imagined to both have access to more, but who also must be, disdained and hated for that very same reason.
What can you tell us, Judith, about the thinking behind the structure of the book through its, there's an introduction, 8 chapters, an epilogue, and you're tracking this history over the first 100 years of French colonialism in Algeria. And at the same time, the different chapters of the book are taking up different aspects of colonial law, the relationship between French law and Muslim law, the issues of polygamy, repudiation, child marriage that come up in different ways through these chapters. Like, how did you think through structuring the book, trying to move from 1830 to 1930, but also coming at these different pockets of sources and themes? Like, how did that thinking work?
Oh, it was really tough.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, here again, I've suggested the way in which the 1870 moment, and I think maybe this is, in part because I really, began as a specialist of the Third Republic, was where I began. And those were actually the first chapters that I wrote. Huh. And I'm actually just realizing this now. But the first chapter that I wrote was actually the child marriage chapter.
Huh.
You know, and it is perhaps because it is the moment that I, when I began writing, that I knew the best. And then I wrote outward from the middle.
Really?
I knew that moment was the hinge of the argument. And then what I was doing was, writing the, in a sense, the before and the after. So part of what I realized once I had the core argument was, what were the issues that, or the questions that surged forth at specific moments. Right. The question of polygamy obviously persists throughout. Mm-hmm. There are ways in which it plays a particularly important role, I argue, in the 1850s and 60s as part of various schemes to reimagine, kind of land and family. And that's what gives rise ultimately to the Valnier Law. And then child marriage surges to the fore in the 1870s and 1880s as precisely a way, and 1890s as a way to kind of reassert the power of French jurisdiction over Muslim personal status. And then, I have a chapter on the problem of mixed marriage and the need mm-hmm. to figure out whose law in a mixed marriage should predominate, and whether the patriarchal principle or the superiority of French women's civil status should prevail. And then I also have the central chapter on the army sodomy scandal, mm-hmm. which in a sense, appears at the center of the book as a kind of exception, and it is about its status as an exception. Yeah. And here I sort of strategically place the chapter on the sodomy scandal, in which an army captain is accused of having an affair with both his, or it's a captain in the Spahi, both with his subordinates in his regiment, and also with youth from the town in which the regiment is housed in Medea. Mm-hmm. And part of what I'm doing there is juxtaposing the treatment of young women or girls in forced marriages with the relative lack of interest
right.
in the captain's relationship with this 15-year-old boy.
Right. Can we talk about sovereignty, Judith? Like, it's in the title, but also how you think about this book as thinking through the question of sovereignty in a few different ways, whether it's with respect to French legal domination of Algeria, but also the kind of very physical material domination of a lot of Algerian land. And then also that kind of notion of sovereignty as a way of characterizing, I don't know, patriarchal authority in a broader sense in either the French or the Muslim family.
So that is a fabulous question. And yet, I'm not sure how we got to this point in the conversation without sort of tackling that that question head on. I mean, yes, there are many moving pieces in the book, but
yeah,
thinking about the relationship between the problem of sexual regulation and sovereignty is, again, I would say at the core of the book. Right. So the problem is, how could the French manage to maintain, a kind of integral conception or system of law while also managing difference, mm-hmm. right? Which is a historic, French problem, right? That is, borne out in very kind of specific and particular ways in the Algerian context. Right. And that's, in fact, one of the reasons why I took up the question of French-Algerian history in my own work in the first place, is thinking about what role the history of French Algeria has in and for that problem.
Right.
Clearly, what I'm, pursuing throughout is how the history of the kind of legal government in Algeria poses repeated problems to the fantasy of kind of, integral, coherent, uniform, and universal French sovereignty, right? Mm-hmm. That was at the core of the project of, for example, the Napoleonic Civil Code, right? Which is clearly tested in diverse ways by the colonial project. Right, in which there is, at once an effort to assert the supremacy of the civil code, but also a clear confrontation with its limits and some of its own internal contradictions, not least in the way in which it inscribes French women's subordination.
I want to come back to this book as a legal history and just what kind of legal historian you are, Judith. You have this great moment, I think it's in the introduction, where you talk about this as a history of the cultural life of Algerian colonial law. And I guess I want to ask, how you get at that, how you manage through your sources, through the emphasis on particular subjects or, voices, I guess, to access this broader, generous conception of a legal history that isn't just about the passage of legislation and the management of those things, but it's about thinking about law through colonial society. And also as a kind of piece of that, how this then becomes a history that isn't just about what jurists are thinking, saying, wanting, doing, but that accesses colonial, accesses Algerian experience and doesn't just access Algerian male experience, but accesses the maybe harder to come by experiences of Algerian women.
So especially since, I have a background, not just in, intellectual history, but in literary mm-hmm. and cultural history more broadly. My own inclination is to not hew exclusively to the legal discourses and texts themselves. So that meant, reading more broadly in, different kinds of, sources, mm-hmm. whether it be, literature, journalism, and of course, archival sources that, took me in, all sorts of different directions, including, as you noted, trying to think about, how and where the women are in these stories, mm-hmm. where they appear in the archive and where they disappear, given the fact that their claims about their victimization suffuse the legal argumentation set forth by so many jurists.
Right.
So what is striking, and this is true even, you know, just, you know, if you read the jurisprudence itself, like women are, you know, appearing everywhere, at least as litigants. Notably, they, and I underscore this, they can appear on all sides of cases. So, you know, this is true, for example, in the, you know, inheritance disputes that that raise questions about the legitimacy of polygamy, in the kind of forced marriage or child marriage disputes, questions surrounding marital consent. So, you know, they are clearly operating as kind of legal, you know, agents and advocates. You know, we sort of, you know, see this throughout. At the same time, part of what I'm trying to do is also go beyond a story simply about legal pluralism. I'm interested in sort of supplementing an idea of people kind of operating out of their own, you know, kind of interests, material and otherwise, by, you know, taking advantage of the situations in courtrooms in order to understand, like, what are the imaginaries that inform their actions, mm-hmm. right? And so that's where, in a sense, you know, another way in which we see kind of, you know, interest and imagination, right? The domain of fantasy operating. And, you know, that's, you know, part of what I try to do, even in my, you know, in my treatment of spare archives, right? So when I pose questions about, okay, well, you know, the women in the very first chapter who are seeking to convert to Catholicism in order to escape unhappy family situations, and what mm-hmm. did their stories tell us about the possibilities opened and foreclosed by the chaotic initial years of the conquest? Or, you know, importantly, the silencing of women who in the 1870s are writing in to the land surveyor commissions, reclaiming property titles that these commissaires have denied them, because it's difficult for French officials to conceive that, you know, women might be a kind of independent, you know, have independent possession of land, mm-hmm. right? And so part of what I'm trying to do is indeed, you know, kind of capture and weave those voices in order to show how the projections and presumptions built into French fantasies of a Muslim family law ultimately silence and sideline those, you know, voices and positions.
Mm-hmm. Judith, I don't want to suggest for one second that there's not enough in this book or that, you know, you needed to do more, but I am interested to know or to learn about the decision to do 100 years, you know, to span this period of time, you know, how you think of ending with 1930 and looking at the centenary, like how that works. And then I don't know if there are things that you see as openings at the other end of, you know, of the project, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was interested in playing with the artifice of the centenary, mm-hmm. right? And that is very clear. And that's how I frame the epilogue.
Right.
The idea is to foreground the phantasmatic element of integrity that is built into the idea of a centenary, right. That it was supposed to celebrate the high point of colonization at the very moment in which, in fact, its fissures were becoming increasingly visible. The fantasy of the centenary mm-hmm. encapsulated the very dynamic between, you know, the denegation or denial built into the idea that French Algeria could be held up as a sparkling, you know, an integrated success mm-hmm. At the very moment that, in fact, the fissures and impossibility of that project were becoming increasingly palpable.
Right.
Right. And I really try to make it clear that, you know, that I am not myself embracing this as an actual periodization. It is an attempt to kind of pose the problem of periodization itself.
Yes.
By highlighting the artifice that was built into that imagined periodization as itself a colonial fantasy. Now, I also think that there's a way in which the terrain of Algerian and French Algerian politics enters just a whole new, you know, register, that there is a significant transformation in the field. I said terrain before, I should say field of politics with the rise of the Ulema movement. In the 1930s, that I also just didn't feel like I don't have the knowledge or that expertise, you know, including the Arabic, in order to really give adequate treatment to it. And there's a way in which the woman question does come to the fore in whole new ways in the 1930s. And I know that there are, you know, other scholars who are working on that now and will be able to shed light on it in ways that, you know, hopefully we'll be able to build on my work, but that I felt like, you know, would be best left to other scholars, right, given the extent to which really the project of my book is to foreground this tension or the dynamic between the fantasy of the project of being able to assert and achieve an effective colonial sovereignty in the course of this imagined whole of an 100-year period, and the extent to which that fantasy, as all fantasies are, was based on, you know, repression and denial at once, you know, military, economic, and psychic.
Yeah. Right.
So that there is a way in which the centenary allowed me to kind of recapitulate in, you know, miniature dynamic that I'm tracing over the course of the whole book. And importantly, right, what I foreground is the extent to which this is something that young Algerian critics of the, you know, fantasy of French colonial sovereignty are pointing to in their attacks on the centenary itself, right? Mm-hmm. So it becomes a way in which I am able to fold that critique into the conclusion and epilogue of the book.
So, Judith, let's wind down by taking on secularism, which I feel like we could talk about that for 3 days. But I guess to narrow that down a little bit, to ask you how you see this book as, I don't even know if I am narrowing it down when I ask this question, but to how you see this book as a contribution to that ever complicated field of, you know, the history and politics of laïcité, yeah, from whenever you want to start to,
right,
you know, tomorrow, right, or next week or whatever. So yeah, I mean, obviously we've touched on so many ways in which, you know, religion plays a role throughout the book, but yeah, how do you see this book as participating in that conversation, which is of course a conversation that's like ongoing, you know, here in 2021, when it comes to thinking about, you know, the legacies of this colonial context.
So thank you. And yes, these questions, you know, have been on my mind. I mean, really since the, you know, I finished my my first book, which in fact ended with a discussion of Republican schools and the question of the headscarf affair. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we're obviously part of what I was thinking about and with throughout the time that I was working on this one, right? Thinking about the problem of like why, how and why Islam seems to pose a challenge to and problem for Republican, you know, sovereignty and government. Mm-hmm. And what you've noted in the, you could say, compulsive repetition in the discourse on laïcité, especially as it has emerged or reemerged, shall we say, since 1989 and the first headscarf affair, is precisely what the book is about, is how do we understand that that compulsive repetition? Right. And the way in which the book gets at that is to think about how the conflict is sort of baked in from the beginning and reproduces itself. right? So that we have the 2004 law on headscarves, we have the 2010 burqa ban, we have the resurgence of the burkini controversies in 2016, and now we have the law reinforcing Republican principles that targets things like polygamous foreigners and virginity tests. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's a way in which the structure of these laws is constantly reproducing the very problem that they imagine to be or they're purportedly solving. Right. Mm-hmm. And they do so in ways that, in a sense, what they do is they manage to, on the one hand, consolidate an idea of, a secular and integral, a phantasmatic secular and integral Republican legality, citizen and subject, but one who is always under threat. Or threatened by an internal difference or dissolution.
Right.
And part of what the book traces is, you could say, the psychic and libidinal dimensions of that, as well as the practical, the practical dimensions, right? Because that, what they do is they underwrite and underscore the necessity for, ever new tactics of legal surveillance and government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we see this, right? It becomes, it produces the need to speak ever more about the problem of Muslim difference. It's the kind of the reproductive hypothesis, right, where it's producing ever more discourse on the problem, even as it purports to be targeting it. The goal is not actually to dissolve it, but actually to continue to it's generative, right? It's a generative form of repression that underwrites, surveillance.
I think for me, reading the book, we say this all the time, that the world needs historians to illuminate these things that people continue to talk about and fight about in the present. And reading this book, I was really just over and over again struck by, its varied resonances with more recent debates, like in the last couple of years, but also, reaching back to 1989. So you describe the project, have described the project as a history of the present. And, could you tell us, in relationship to what we've just been talking about, but kind of more broadly, like, what does that mean for you methodologically and in terms of your approach as a researcher and writer?
I think that this is, I think on the blurb or cover, back cover of the book, right? The history of the present perspective that I hope to provide is to trouble the idea that, in a sense, we know why, when we think Muslim law, we think about the family and a particularly patriarchal structure of the family. Right. And I am providing a kind of back history of the emergence of that association in the French legal imaginary and in French law in order to, to demonstrate its deep imbrication in a violent expropriative colonial history in ways that can then help us to identify the ways in which that fantasy is invested and mobilized for, in tactical and, political reasons in the present.
Mm-hmm. Well, having asked you that question, let me now transition goofily, awkwardly to the future. What are you working on now?
So I am, basically I, So as you noted, like I end with the centenary, and now I'm basically I'm skipping over the last 32 years, or depending on how you want to date it, of French Algeria, purportedly French Algeria, to work on the basically family law conflicts after decolonization. So exploring how, you know, in a sense, what happens when a Muslim law status, personal status, family law, that had been a subordinated colonial status, becomes, you know, and under the aegis of an independent Algerian state, accedes to sovereign equality, and how then family law conflicts between France and Algeria play out after decolonization, and their deep implication in the unsettled character of the post-colonial collaboration or cooperation that emerges out of the framework of the Evian Accords. More specifically, what I'm looking at are basically divorce and custody disputes, particularly between French women and Algerian men, in which French courts give custody to French mothers and Algerian courts give custody to Algerian men. And so you have the a kind of pure conflict of law situation in which these cases become, you know, diplomatic and emotional ping pong balls, as one contemporary writer describes them. And basically, I'm focusing on them as a kind of microcosm of the gendered, sexual, economic, and political tensions that persist between France and Algeria, arguably, one could say, to this day, right? And we see this, obviously, with the recent publication of the Staha report and the question of the desirability or not of an attempt to reconcile French and Algerian memory. And part of what I'm interested in exploring is the torn, contradictory, and challenged position of the children who are, emerge out of these, you know, are part of these families, and how they, at the time and since, kind of negotiate. You know, at once, you know, legally, you know, emotionally, culturally, psychically, being between the two nations. What's been great about it is that I've, you know, I have gotten access to the, you know, kind of legal dossiers, but have also begun to be in conversation with Franco-Algerian children themselves, and like, so the new, very new aspect of the. Of the project for me is this, you know, kind of oral historical dimension. So that's my, you know, if the last book, you know, did a, you know, a lot new in working on legal history, this this book is going to think about kind of oral history and relationship to law. I mean, oral history and like also the kind of cultural production, and thinking about how some of these children are kind of seeking out, you know, alternatives to the framework of law. Right. Is also part of what I'm going to be exploring, and like, you know, kind of cultural production in contrast to the legal framework of struggling sovereigns.
Well, it sounds like an amazing project, and I hope when it's ready, no pressure, you just finished this book, that you'll come back and talk to me about it on the podcast. Judith, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and for writing this wonderful book.
Well, thank you so much, Roxanne. And I just want to say thank you for today and for all of the wonderful interviews that you do, since I enjoy on a regular basis being able to learn from you and others, thanks to your, you know, intrepid and energetic podcasting presence.